Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padre Greedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, welcome to another Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with a special guest host, Marcus Chown. Marcus has been on the show a couple of times before, so he doesn't really need much introduction, but I will say that his first popular science book, Afterglow of Creation, has just been re-released by Faber and Faber. It's about the first light from the Big Bang being discovered, so you should go out and buy that. But we're not here to talk about that tonight. We're here to talk to our guest, Stuart Clarke, who Marcus is now going to introduce.
Right, well, Stuart is an astronomer and an author and an all-round nice bloke. He's a bit rock and roll, and maybe later in the programme he'll explain that. He's a visiting fellow in astronomy at the University of Hertfordshire. He's written several excellent and critically acclaimed popular science books, and he's even writing a trio of novels about the history of cosmology, which sounds really interesting. But his most recent best-selling book is The Sun Kings, which is about, well, Stuart, what is it about?
What's it about? Thank you, Marcus. The Sun Kings is actually about one of the most apocalyptic celestial events that's ever been witnessed from the Earth. In 1859, the entire planet was engulfed by this blood-red aurora. It took the population by surprise. It took scientists completely by surprise. And it was so damaging that it led to every compass on the planet going haywire while this huge aurora was going on, and the telegraph network went down. Operators were stunned unconscious by the electricity surging through the wires.
And the telegraph was kind of like the Victorian internet.
It was indeed. They did. They used the telegraph for everything that we use the internet for today.
They were actually stunned.
Possibly, yes, they were sort of stunned unconscious by the electricity. Offices burst into flames because of this. And when the government leaders turned to the scientists and said, "What on earth happened?" They literally didn't know. The only person, this is our plucky hero of the book, the only person who had been in the right place at the right time was an amateur astronomer called Richard Carrington, and he'd actually had seen the explosion on the sun that triggered this event, and that set astronomy on a path of trying to understand how our planet is connected to the sun in ways beyond mere heat and light.
How did he see it?
He happened to be trying to catalogue the temporary blemishes that appear on the sun, the sunspots. And so that morning he had his telescope rigged up looking at the sun, and he was projecting the image onto a big board, because you must never, ever look at the sun through a telescope. The light is so powerful it will blind you. And he was just watching the sun, and he was sketching the sunspots, and there was a particularly large sunspot that day that from end to end stretched about 10 times the diameter of the Earth. And as he watched, so this sudden, well, two brilliant beads of white light appeared above the sunspot group, and over the course of about 5 minutes they moved across the sunspot. He calculated that they'd travelled across the solar surface at something like 120,000 miles per hour, which for Victorians getting used to steam trains going at 50 miles an hour was a pretty wild number.
You've just mentioned that Carrington was studying sunspots. So before we talk about the discovery of this solar flare and what that's led to, let's go back a while and talk about when people first started to study. When did people first decide that the sun was worthwhile of studying itself?
Yeah, so there have been a number of records of huge sunspots that crop up. But the real study didn't begin until the invention of the telescope, at which point you could magnify the sun and actually see that there were these blemishes on there. Now, the actual study of the sunspots, then by cruel fate and sheer coincidence, the sun went through one of its periodic lapses in activity just a few decades after Galileo's first use of the astronomical telescope. So Galileo looked at sunspots in around about 1610, but then in 1645... the sun just went into this profound lull of activity. There were hardly any sunspots at all until 1715.
And that's connected with the Little Ice Age, isn't it, in Europe?
In Europe, there is this coincidence that the worst years of the Little Ice Age seem to be around... Yes, there seemed to be around this time when there were no sunspots, and even now we have no firm understanding of whether there's a causal link there or whether that is just truly coincidence.
That's something I want to return to later. We can have a talk a little bit more about those links. But let's look at William Herschel as a scientist that people will all have heard of. For other reasons, but perhaps let's look at what he was doing and what was his involvement with the study of the sun.
Yeah, so William Herschel is my first sun king in the book, if you like. And he was principally involved in the discovery and the subsequent study of variable stars. So he knew that there were stars in the universe that varied their light. Now, he was also very well aware of the fossils of the marine reptiles that were being discovered in Lyme Regis at the time as well. And the only interpretation they had for these fossils was that they looked a bit like crocodiles. And the idea was that, well, perhaps England was once much warmer, that perhaps the Earth was much warmer. And Herschel believed that perhaps the two were linked, that a warmer England was because there had once been a warmer sun, a variable sun. And what he said in around about the turn of the 19th century is that he likened it to the study of the flooding of the River Nile. And he said, we need to turn this astronomical science to a bold new use, that we don't just look and catalogue the positions, but we actually try to understand the workings of the celestial objects, especially the sun. Because if the sun does become variable, then there is no way we can change that. We can't affect that. But perhaps we could see it coming and do something on Earth to compensate or to live with that change. In the same way that when the Egyptians predicted whether the Nile would flood or not and whether they would get a good harvest or not, well, they could lay in provisions and make contingency plans.
But at this time, there was a lot of people that were studying the skies and people were cataloguing stars, for instance, but there was a practical purpose for this in that this was to do with navigation. I get the impression that it was frowned upon almost, that people would study the sun for the sake of scientific study.
Absolutely, that's completely right. When there was this clear and definite practical reason for studying the sun to aid navigation, so there seemed to be no further need for any other use of astronomy. Now, that changed once and for all at this apocalyptic event in 1859, because with the sudden breakdown of all global navigation and communications because of the effect on the compasses and the telegraphs, suddenly we became aware that the Earth is in thrall to these giant forces beyond our planet that we had no idea how to explain.
Can you put the 1859 solar storm in perspective? I mean, obviously we have solar storms, or we've had them since. How does it compare to all the ones we've had since, or we have records of?
We have just one magnetic reading that stayed on the scale from 1859, and you're right to ask this question, because it's been a source of much headache, actually, in that all the magnetic observatories around the world, this storm was so intense, it shot the needles off the scales. But there's one observatory in India, which just by dint of where it is in the globe and how far away it is from the South Magnetic Pole, stayed on the map or stayed on the scale. And that's allowed us to calculate the actual size of the magnetic storm. And it is at least 4 or 5 times larger than anything we've experienced since.
And if we had something like that today, I mean, obviously we don't have a telegraph, we don't have to worry about things like that, but presumably we are more vulnerable.
our increased reliance on electrical systems does indeed leave us open to vulnerability to these electrical effects and these solar storms. A recent study by the National Academies of Sciences in America found that the greatest danger is to power stations and transformers. And in 1989, a power station in Quebec had its transformer melted effectively by a solar storm. A Carrington-sized event today, according to the National Academy of Sciences, could potentially cause a chain reaction through the eastern seaboard of America and knock out dozens of power stations. And those are really big and expensive pieces of equipment to build and to replace. And we could potentially be looking at the loss of power there for months or even years.
So we're talking about these magnetic fields inducing massive, massive currents that just burn out electrical equipment. And presumably, I mean, what about electronics? I mean, what about satellites?
Satellites as well would be in grave danger from these events. So in 2003, we had a sequence of solar storms. And as these giant eruptions barreled through space towards a spacecraft called SOHO, which is a solar watchdog that sits between the Earth and the Sun and watches for this kind of activity, as it was nearing the spacecraft, so the controllers turned it off. They just turned everything off, put it to sleep, which is the only effective safety precaution that you can take against these storms.
Let's get back to Carrington then. He makes this connection between this all these events that are happening and something happening on the Sun. What's the reaction of the establishment, the scientific establishment?
Almost completely utter disbelief. And the situation that Carrington was fighting against was that ever since 1687, when Isaac Newton had published the Principia and in it his laws of gravity, well, that seemed to explain virtually all motion throughout the universe. And so gravity was thought to be the only force that could communicate itself across space. And then along came Carrington, who saw this giant flare. And at the moment of the flare, the magnetic needles in the Kew Observatory also gave a little kick. And then about 18 hours later, this gigantic magnetic storm erupted around the world. And that was suggesting that magnetism too could reach out across space and strike the Earth.
So this was a significant event that implied that the Earth was not isolated from cosmic events. So it was a real sea change in how we think about the cosmos and its effects on us.
Indeed, when John Donne wrote that no man is an island, this is the event that proves that no planet is one either.
And this event, I think you said when I was talking to you before, also coincided with the birth of astrophysics by a bizarre coincidence. Can you tell us what astronomy is and what astrophysics is and what actually happened?
Yeah, so as Neil correctly pointed out earlier, that astronomy at the time was all to do with charting the positions of the stars to aid with navigation. And that is what we traditionally think of as astronomy. Astrophysics is the application of what we know about the laws of physics to the celestial objects in order to try and understand how they behave and potentially how they can affect us. And it was thought to be almost impossible to do that until 1859.
Wasn't it Auguste Comte, the French philosopher, who said, did you make a list of things that science would never be able to do?
It was indeed.
One of them was find the composition of the stars.
Exactly. That was thought to be entirely impossible. And then in 1859, Bunsen and Kirchhoff showed how you could do it. And that is because when light travels through a hot vapour, specific wavelengths of that light are absorbed depending upon the chemical composition of the cloud. And so if you split the light through a spectrum, you see this pattern of dark lines, which is effectively like a barcode for each of the elements. So you can work out the chemical composition of the celestial objects and certain things about its physical condition as well. And just as the Carrington event hit the Earth, and proved the need for doing this, so Bunsen and Kirchhoff realised how you could do it. It's the most spectacular coincidence that when mankind needed or had the motivation to go and understand the celestial objects, so nature sort of provided us with the means to go and do it.
But the UK made a mistake at this point.
As we often do in this country, we got hung up on tradition and what was newfangled and not anything to do with befitting an English gentleman to be doing. And so there was this plunged astronomy into crisis in this country. Should we abandon the traditional role of Greenwich in charting the positions of the stars and turn it to astrophysics? Or should we, in fact, as was suggested and quite vigorously pushed, open a new British astrophysical observatory? Well, the Astronomer Royal, George Airy at the time, who was in charge of Greenwich, he was fantastically adept politician as well. And he convinced the powers that be that Greenwich could also do some astrophysics. And that stopped this idea of setting up a dedicated astrophysical observatory. But Airy's heart wasn't really in astrophysics. He was getting on in years as well, somewhat stuck in his ways. So the discipline languished at Greenwich. It was taken up vigorously by amateurs, but you're right, it cost us the lead, and nations like America embraced it wholeheartedly and just went for it.
Before we go into the second half of the show, I just want to really bring us right up to date on this and talk about something that you mentioned earlier, which is the perceived link between sunspots and climate. Now, listeners to the show will be familiar with the argument that's often made of climate change sceptics, that sunspots play a more significant part in global warming than the human influence does. So is there any validity in that?
Well, we happen to be in a very, very interesting period of solar behaviour, once again, in fact. And it should allow us to sort this question out once and for all and incontrovertibly. And that is that for the latter half of the 20th century, the sun and the solar activity has been peculiarly active. And as with the rise of carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, so the average levels of solar activity have been going up as well. So you have not been able to disentangle the contribution from both. Now, the sun is suddenly heading for a profound crash in its activity. There have been hardly any sunspots for the last 2 years, and small-scale solar activity has only returned this year, in fact. And I don't think that anybody truly expects it to go back to its previous levels. So the magnetic activity of the sun is going down and down and down, whereas the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere continue to go up. So now we wait to see what the temperature does, and finally we will be able to disentangle this.
Well, you're listening to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with our guest host, Marcus Chown, and we're talking to Stuart Clark, and we've been talking about his book, The Sun Kings. But Stuart, if we can move on into the in the second half of the show, you've got a new book coming out in July, which is called Big Questions Universe, The 20 Biggest Cosmic Mysteries Made Simple.
So that's the claim, yes.
So we probably can't cover all 20 of those cosmic mysteries, but what sort of things are you going to be looking at in this new book?
Some of the things in this new book are some of them are the perennial questions. Was Einstein right? What are black holes? Are there alternate universes? Is there cosmological evidence for God? Those sorts of things. And one of the focus, one focus for the book is the concept of dark matter. Is there this mysterious substance called dark matter that pervades all of space and provides the sort of cosmic scaffolding that holds galaxies together? And if there isn't such a thing as dark matter, well, what does hold the galaxies together? How do you know? What do we put in place of it?
What is the evidence then? Why do we require dark matter?
So the evidence for dark matter, always, when you look back through history, this is the root of every piece of astronomical inquiry and astronomical breakthrough, is that you see movement that you can't understand. So in the case of, say, Copernicus and Kepler, you were seeing the movement of planets that you couldn't understand. In the case of the discovery of Uranus and then subsequently, or in the case of the discovery of Neptune, rather, you were seeing anomalous movements with the planet Uranus. In the case of general relativity, you were seeing anomalous movements of the planet Mercury. And as astronomers looked out into the wider universe, so the galaxies didn't seem to be moving quite correctly. And the key piece of this evidence came from the study of the way that galaxies rotate. And the outer edges of a galaxy, of nearly all galaxies, in fact, would appear to be moving much faster than you expect from the amount of matter that you can see within the galaxy. So either there is a vast amount of matter in the galaxy that you just can't see, hence we call it dark matter, or, perhaps more excitingly, we don't understand how gravity works.
I've got a time machine. I'm going to bring Newton forward to today. If he saw the astronomical evidence, what would he say?
He would be livid. He would be out of his tree. Remember, Newton couldn't explain the movement of the moon, and that's just the interplay of gravity between the Earth and the Sun, and he couldn't understand that with his laws of gravity. So he pursued Flamsteed, the first astronomer royal, relentlessly to try and get his data, because he felt that if he could just get more accurate data, he could understand the movement of the moon. If Newton knew that every single galaxy didn't follow his law of gravity, he would be incandescent.
Would he modify his law of gravity, or would he go for invisible matter?
Which way would he jump? So in those, he certainly... Okay, I'm going to stick my neck out. He'd modify his laws. Mm-hmm. Yes, he'd modify his laws because he always said you don't need to understand how gravity works. You just need to know that my equation gives you the right answer. So from that point of view, I think secretly he felt there must be a mechanical reason for gravity, the impact of tiny particles or something like that. But publicly, he sort of just maintained that it was enough that the maths told you what was going on, that the universe was mathematical and that was enough and all you needed to know.
Presumably that was Einstein's picture as well, because he just came up with a better description. We still don't actually know what gravity is, do we? As you say, we think it may involve particles called gravitons or whatever. But tell me about this modified gravity, because isn't there an Israeli physicist who has an explanation for the rotation of spiral galaxies?
Yes, there is. There's an Israeli physicist called Mordechai Milgrom. And in the 1980s, when it was starting to be realised that this was a serious problem, this rotation for the galaxies, he started to modify Newton's laws just to see if he could fit these galaxy rotation curves. And he found that he could. And what he needed to do was to introduce a new constant of nature, like the speed of light is a constant. And he said there was a constant, an acceleration, and it's minuscule, it's ever so tiny. It's only about a billionth of the acceleration produced by the Earth's gravity. But what he said is if gravity changes subtly below this acceleration level there and doesn't decay quite as quickly as Newton's law says it does, then I can reproduce the rotation curves of galaxies.
So gravity is stronger than you would expect in the outer regions of galaxies.
Yes. Yeah. Whenever you get into the really weak gravitational field, then gravity starts to act more strongly than you expect. In stronger gravitational regimes, it acts exactly as you understand it to from Newton.
And there's only one number, is there? This acceleration at which you get this change from one type of gravity to another?
That's correct. Just one number. And it correctly reproduced the rotation curves for the galaxies.
In every spiral galaxy?
For pretty much every galaxy that you look at, every galaxy that's been studied before and since, this correction works. But nobody knows how or why.
And presumably the majority of astronomers still go for the dark matter explanation rather than this explanation.
Absolutely. The dark matter is highly popular because it also fits in with the way that the physicists want to think and their attempts to reconcile gravity with the other forces of nature suggest that there are as yet undiscovered particles. And some of those make natural candidates for this dark matter. However, I would say that when I see the models of the dark matter, I don't yet think that any dark matter model correctly explains the rotation curves of galaxies as correctly and as well as this MOND does.
The modified
Newtonian dynamics. So there's a clear tension there in science, a clear paradox. We have a mathematical expression that's simple and elegant and does the job, but we don't know where it comes from. And on the other hand, we have strong reasons for thinking that there are these other particles of nature, but they don't quite seem to do the job that we want them to do correctly.
Presumably there is a precedent, because in the first part of the 20th century we had an old quantum theory which was empirical. Niels Bohr came up with a description of how atoms give out light, but it had no fundamental physics basis. That came in the 20s or 30s. I mean, could it be that the fundamental physics will come later?
Indeed, and again, if you look back through history, these empirical laws always come before the actual theoretical understanding. Kepler's laws of planetary motion have no theoretical basis, but they fed into Newton's law of gravity, and that gave it the theoretical basis.
As well as the idea of dark matter, there's another thing called dark energy, which is often used to explain the speed at which the universe is expanding and whatever. Is there any link? Is this a similar thing?
Some people have... Yes, that's another chapter in the book, the dark energy.
So just say that those two account for 96%.
If these things exist, then they dwarf everything. We are less. The visible matter is less than the head on a pint of Guinness. We are, you know, the cosmic foam on this. So dark energy is even more mysterious than dark matter. Whereas dark matter, there are candidates from serious physics. There's no comfortable or easy fit for dark energy in any law of physics.
Well, that's perhaps another profound nugget to take us into the weekend. We're out of time. So, Stuart, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
It's been my pleasure.
And thanks to Marcus for co-hosting so admirably.
It's been my pleasure as well.
Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.